All right, we were speaking last week about this collision course between the Roman Augustan view of pietas or piety and the Christian sort of view of piety and the conflicting claims, because essentially Augustus Caesar and Jesus were basically claiming the same thing, okay? That is, ruler of the known universe. And that conflict was bound to play out. And so the next, 400 years of history is the story of that playing out of those conflicting claims. And when the Emperor Constantine sees the cross in the sky and hears whoever's voice it is saying in hoc signo vincit, he's going to go and be Christ's king. Okay, so the merging of the Roman Empire with Christianity occurs, and the battle is over after a fashion. Okay, it's really never over, and St. Augustine's City of God tells you that it will never be over, because remember, he's writing post-Constantine and kind of at the time of the fall of the Western Roman Empire. So now we're going to move into the second half of the book, which if you've shown up for lesson three, you've been a brave soul. It's going to now move really into a biblical analysis, specifically of Ephesians, Galatians, and some of the pastoral epistles. And he's trying to essentially make this argument for what the battle's going to look like. So the first part of the second half of the book, he titles Waging Peace. Okay, and what he's going to do is he's going to essentially make the case that our weapons are not the same weapons that the Roman Empire used, and that every subsequent human authority more or less uses to coerce obedience and enforce their view of the universe. So he goes to Ephesians chapter 5, and he goes through a very familiar passage. These are our theme verses at Rocky this year, kind of our founding verses. This was the original emblem that Bob Greed had for the school, had a knight in armor with a shield, and it's because of this passage, okay? So let's just go through a little bit of Ephesians 5 here. It says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood." Okay, so in other words, here's your key, that our fight is not like the Romans' fight, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So we read those passages, and if you're thoroughly modern, you kind of scratch your head and go, I wonder what he's talking about there. The devil? Okay, got it. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand, be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. Therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and the shoes for your feet, having put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace. In all circumstances, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming darts of the evil one, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Praying at all times, in the Spirit, and with all prayer and supplication, to that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints, and also for me, that words may be given to me in opening of my mouth, boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, chains, that I may declare it boldly as I ought to speak. So, the part of this that Wiley is going to emphasize is that our weapons of warfare are not the same as a Roman soldier's. Okay, and this analogy is making that clear. The other part he's going to foot stomp is this sort of muddly, confusing, what does this really mean section, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. He's going to go through with us what a first century Roman Empire reader would understand by that passage. It would not have been, I wonder what he's talking about. They would have known exactly what he's talking about. And really, up until kind of the Enlightenment, the present, last 250 years maybe, everybody would have basically gotten that passage. Okay? And it's because of our understanding of the nature of things and the nature of the universe that we live in that we sort of don't get this passage as well as our predecessors. So, how is it that we're going to think about this? So, Wiley's going to talk about the cosmos for a bit. So, if you're old like me, you look at this smiling Cornell PhD, and you say, Carl Sagan. Okay, he had a show back on PBS, 70s. I'm thinking. Look at that hair, my wife says. Okay, not standing where I am and seeing if anybody's got that haircut. Okay, which, you would never say, look at that hair if somebody has that haircut. Okay, I would say, look at that turtleneck. Okay, Sagan had this TV show, and basically, if you've been through the Truth Project makes a lot of Sagan's little TV show as well. So people that weren't alive to watch it in the 70s can see it. But he would essentially, begin. The show is called The Cosmos, and he would begin with, "The cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. Our feeblest contemplation of the cosmos stir us. There's a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation, as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries." So Sagan is basically popularizing a modern, materialistic view of the universe, scientism, if you will. And he's got a little bit of a New Agey sort of, you can tell kind of by the poetry here. He wants to, he's presenting us a philosophy that really has zero room for anything emotional. Okay, there, if you have feelings of love in your heart, according to scientific materialism, it's a delusion. Okay, it's something you're doing to make you feel good about the hopelessness of the universe, and or it's the pizza you ate last night. Okay, feelings are meaningless. Okay. Essentially, the universe is just all there is. The mechanisms, the physics, the chemistry, the biology of the universe is all there is. And everything else is blue smoke and mirrors. So, love, joy, peace, freedom, hope, all the things that stir people to go do great things, it's bunkum. Okay, so it's a skeptical, cynical view of the universe. So if you grew up in the U.S. school system in certainly the 60s and 70s like I did, this is what you got. Okay, this is the philosophy that you got. And so Sagan is a popularizer in the sense that he's trying to make it seem, how profound. And he's trying to give you a little sense of what they've taken away with the actual philosophy. He's trying to give you a little sense of that back. So that view of the cosmos, everybody of a certain age and a certain educational system basically took for that, well, that's the way it is, right? You've got the periodic table. That proves it, okay? Or you've got the the drawings in the science book of, you know, the one cell, you know, thing, and then the fish, and then the fish walking on the ground, and then the, you know, something else, then a monkey, and then an ape walking on two legs, and then, you know, a hairy guy, okay, and then, you know, some guy in a business suit. Okay, so, you know, those illustrations were in all of my science books, and I think probably my history books as well. When I first went as an undergrad in the late 70s to a thoroughly secular progressive university, what I was struck with was my impression in middle school and high school had been evolution's like a science thing. And, you know, if you're not in science classes, it doesn't really mean anything else. And what I realized is when I went to math class and I went to a law and government class and I went to, you know, a literature class, evolution was the philosophic underpinning of everything. Every academic discipline had this as its starting point. And when I'm in my math class, which I was a math major for a bit, when I was in my math class, it was a set theory class, and, you know, I've got one of the authors of the book in which they take set theory and they basically evolutionize it and make it the basis of mathematics. So, wow. That's a sleight of hand. Okay, so, you know, this is really where, hey, Andrew, this is really where modernity, if you will, starts. Now, I'm going to say the subsequent philosophies. So here's scientific materialism. Well, I'm not going to be that. I'm going to be an existentialist. They start with these assumptions about the nature of the universe. Postmodernism, okay? It doesn't reinvent new assumptions. It takes these as the assumptions and then says, well, now what are we going to do about it? Okay? So everybody really starts here, even if they're not a practicing scientific materialist, in terms of their outlook on life. So, you know, the pink-haired kid with a million tats and, you know, a screwdriver through their nose doesn't look much like Carl Sagan, okay? But the philosophic assumptions are basically the same, okay? When you get down to, you know, what's the nature of reality, nobody really challenges it except for biblical Christianity and maybe, you know, maybe if you're like a dyed-in-the-wool Eastern thinker, you know, maybe you can argue that they do. So, what was the thinking about the cosmos before scientific materialism started developing, you know, Enlightenment onwards? Okay, so, the answer to that question is, this is a picture that maybe gives you an idea. There's God in his heaven. Okay, and down at the bottom, that green stuff is us on the earth. Okay, and there are layers of not just stuff, but beings in this structure that we call the universe. And so I'm not really going to talk about this today, but I read a book a year or so ago about, it was called C.S. Lewis and the Music of the Spheres, I think. But it's basically the idea of astronomy pre-scientific materialism. And astronomy was probably the most theologically grounded of all of the disciplines in kind of the old classical learning system because of what they believe about the nature of the universe. So those look like stars and planets and stuff, and you can see some symbols. This has to do with the old zodiac system, okay, basically being tied into this. So again, this is a completely different study, but I'm telling you that the way people thought about the universe that we live in pre-Enlightenment, pre-scientific materialism, is completely different than the way we think about it. Okay, you won't look at the evening sky the same once you kind of go dip your toes in this water. Yes, Mike?
Can you talk about the Would you like to comment, if it's not too much of a left turn, on Paul's third heaven?
Well, that's part of this idea. So when you read that verse that Paul's explaining kind of his credentials, and I know a man, I'm not going to, you know, that little literary technique, I'm not going to say who he is, he was caught up into the third heaven. Okay, that's part of this framework, okay? And this is what basically everybody understood about the nature of the universe, okay? So there's an order in the creation. Now, as Christians, we certainly believe in the order of the universe, right? Okay? That's the point of science in our view, and that's certainly, you know, early modern science was thoroughly Christian. And if you go back to basically almost all of the discoveries that populate high school science textbooks, those are all early modern science discoveries that essentially were done by Christians who said, okay, God made the universe. We can learn about God by reading his word, but we can also learn about God by studying what he has made. And there, according to Romans 1, there's a testimony about God in those leaves out there. Okay, and that tree and chlorophyll and, you know, the Fibonacci sequence. Okay, you can see God's fingerprints everywhere. So that's this idea. Okay, and then you basically have this order here, and then the argument for this half of the book is going to be there's a way that we recreate that order in our own daily life. So we're a participant in this big order, but we recreate this order in these, you know, little spheres that we occupy. And so the orders that we create are reflections of the order that God has created. Follow? Makes kind of sense, right? Yes, Peter?
Would that imply that if our lives are chaotic or unordered, it's not just the chaos that would be unorderly and bad, but it being in conflict with order itself?
Yes. Okay, and so on the grand scheme, so when I get to the grand scheme and talk about that a little bit, I will actually address that question. That's a great question, by the way, Andrew.
Thank you.
Okay, so there's a structure and an order in the universe that we participate in the grand scheme, but we also have a share in our immediate lives. Okay, a mirror of that. And so the way Wiley says it is there's a verticality. I'm not sure that's the most helpful word. There's a verticality to the created order. Okay, so I'm going to actually just use the description that the ancients and the medievals and the early moderns sort of all used in a second. But he lists some passages in Ephesians where this verticality is being referenced. Okay, so there's a lot of them. I probably won't spend the time to go through all of them because I want to dwell on other verses later. But the idea of this authority, this hierarchy, so hierarchies are a very, very bad word nowadays, right? Okay, hierarchy is like cloning. So, you know, it's us wanting to rule over people we have no business ruling over. Okay, but hierarchy is one of the words here that they believe fiercely in. Okay, so Wiley does go to some effort. Okay, so in a book that's had a lot of classical arguments, okay, he's really trying to get you to see, you know, through this window into sort of classical literature, that this is really how everybody understood the world, but it's also biblical. Okay, so he's going to say that the ancients had it right about this. So he's not going to really spend a ton of time in the second half of the book accessing classical references, okay, because, again, you know, Rome, Augustus Caesar and Jesus came to this, and now he's going to explain how we win and this is how we win. All right. So this verticality is the way he describes it. The way I would describe it is sort of this idea of the great chain or the great scale of being. So this is the ancient and sort of medieval view. One of the best explanations of this is C.S. Lewis wrote a preface to Paradise Lost. It's pretty academic, but that's in all the things I've ever read, and I've read a lot of medieval stuff. Lewis's explanation of this is he's essentially explaining what Milton believed, and that's how you understand Paradise Lost. So the idea is that up here's God. Okay, then he's got other created beings underneath him, so we'll just call them angels for now. Okay, then he's got people. This is the simplified version that I would always give kids at school. Then he's got people underneath it. Then he's got animals, and he's got rocks and stuff, and I would always add that are the Yankees. And I don't mean the ball team. I mean people born up north. But I can't say that in here because many of you were born up north, and I love you. So this is more in my Southern partisan days. So you've got this chain of being. Now, between us and God, there are ranks of angelic beings. Okay, so that principalities, powers, authorities, those are all titles, okay, and ranks. Now, we know that some of the angels fell, right? Okay, so that's going to move them down the chain. So, to Andrew's very perceptive question, the way that Christians certainly understood this scale of nature, chain of being, was that when you sin, you're actually acting like something lower than you on the chain of being. Okay? So, when I lust as a man, I'm acting like animals that are lustful, say, billy goats. Okay. When I am greedy, I'm acting like an animal lower than me that's greedy. Let's say a wolf. Okay. When I'm fierce and going to tear somebody limb from limb because they insulted me, I'm acting like an animal that's lower than me on the chain. Okay. Let's say a bear. Okay. So the idea is that as you obey the top of the chain, God, you actually are acting like a higher up. Now remember, the demons are in there above us, okay, but they've lowered themselves because of their actions and attitudes. Okay. However, we're in the process of sanctification actually kind of notching up the ladder. Okay, so this should sound a little bit Catholic to you, right? Okay, it is. The Catholics didn't invent it, but they appropriated it, okay? But medieval theologians and philosophers would make a lot of this sort of idea. Literarily, if you are to ever venture outside your comfort zone and go read Dante's Inferno, well, read the whole thing. Read the whole Divine Comedy to see all of this in action. But if you'll recall, if you have looked at it, Dante's got levels of hell, right? Yeah, he's got levels in heaven too. Nobody ever reads Paradiso because it's not as entertaining as, oh, I know that guy. He's in the fifth level of hell. Ha ha ha. So nobody ever reads Purgatory or Paradiso unless they're forced to. But when you read this, it's the scale of being. It's the chain of being. That's what you see here. And so it's a great sort of artistic or literary depiction of this theory. Now, philosophically, okay, if you are a fan or a student of Thomas Aquinas, this is his model. Okay, this is how he is going to basically frame. So everybody says, well, Aquinas just takes the Bible and Aristotle. Well, Aristotle had a version of this. Okay, in his philosophy. But Aquinas is very, very dependent upon this as sort of his scheme. Okay, so again, this is pretty academic stuff, but the thing that you have to understand is this is how everybody, more or less, looked at the world that they were in. So, you know, we're trained to think about physics and chemistry and biology, okay, as basically the frameworks of the world that we're looking at through that window. They're thinking this. Now, there's science in this, okay, so, you know, they studied elements of science, but they're fitting it into this. Okay, so it's a completely different approach. And Wiley's saying that to understand significant parts of the New Testament, you kind of have to get this idea. Okay? So, put your hand up if you learned this in school.
Learned.
All right.
I went to Catholic school.
Yeah, Catholic. Okay, you got it. Okay. None of the rest of us did. Yes?
I was just going to ask you. Basically, materialism, there's still ideas, there are all kinds of, you know, philosophies and things that are not material, but they're not transcendent. I feel like even the
Greeks
still had a sense of these transcendent realities that spiritual realm.
And in many ways, that's what Sagan was trying to do, is add a transcendent element to scientific materialism. You know, the Truth Project does it really well. It's the box idea, okay? Everything's in the box. Okay, and that's the Sagan idea, and we believe that God's not in the box, right? Okay, and we're not in the box.
Right.
Yes, Nick.
I think there are some theological issues with this structure that I think we can critique. I just wanted to say that that's the case. We don't necessarily have to go into it, but one key element I see is man now is seated at the right hand of God.
Yeah.
And God has removed the angels who were in that place of in the old covenant as the messengers, and man has taken that place. So there is some error, I think, or concern about that theologically.
Well, and so, you know, I'm not teaching the Sunday school over at Holy Name right now, right? Okay.
Absolutely.
So in other words, I think there's some usefulness in understanding this idea. But you know, John Milton wasn't Roman Catholic either, and he kind of subscribed in general to this. But again, I'm not saying, don't take chemistry, kids. You know, study this instead. But I think you should understand that, when Hebrews says we're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. Well, what does that mean? Okay. Well, you know, we're on a stage right now, and we're being watched and observed, and our actions are somehow instructive or edifying, if you will. I'm not going to say entertaining. Hopefully not entertainment. But you know, we're somehow on display. Okay, the Book of Job. You know, Job's on display, right? That's clear. Okay, and that heavenly court is observing Job's reactions. Okay, well, you know, you get knocked upside the head, you know, by some thug, you know, the heavenlies are watching how you're going to respond to that. You know, are you going to go and act like an animal, or are you going to act like an angel?
I think there's some argument to be made that some of this changed with the coming of Christ. Your chain of being gets a little bit adjusted, shall we say.
Yeah.
Eschatologically.
Yeah, so again, I'm not arguing that we do an entire, you know, quarter Sunday school on this. But I do think it is important to understand that the ancients would have had, and medievals and early moderns, would have had a completely different view of a lot of these passages. That's really Wiley's point, is these passages in the New Testament, we can't understand them really without understanding this framework.
Speaking from a secular point of view, in education,
go back to the early moderns, you know, if you read natural philosophy, That's what we would call science, okay? But it was considered part of that philosophy. And of course, in the old universities, theology was the queen of the sciences, right? So there's, you can see evidence of that in even the, still the structure of our higher ed, at least. All right, so this is going to kind of harken back to earlier first half of the book themes, but the understanding of people that understood that they lived in this kind of world, understood that they had duties to higher levels and lower levels. Okay, so again, I would always teach this when I was teaching kids about feudalism in England. Okay, how to understand the idea that I've got obligations to my superiors, to my peers, and to my inferiors in whatever place in the chain of being that I find myself. Okay, because human society is going to be structured on this hierarchy of place and role. And, you know, the key to, you know, happy, healthy, wonderful lives is everybody doing their job at their plug-in spot, okay? So I'm not the boss, so I don't have to worry about this stuff. I am a vassal, so I have to worry about this, okay? I have certain duties, obligations. But key to this, and Wiley footstomps it, so, you know, I would always talk about the duties and the obligations to the kids, but the idea that you owe a debt of gratitude. Okay, you would not have anything that you have that's good without the largesse of the next person on the rung above you. Okay, so now we're 21st century Americans, you know, I got rights. Okay, you can't just walk in and take my rights. You know, this is an idea that my rights are really very, very dependent upon the arbitrary whim of the person in front of me. So something like the Magna Carta, which, you know, yay, you know, that's just the nobles saying, hey, you can't just take away all our rights. It is nothing for regular people like us. Okay, it is that thin wedge underneath the king. Okay, so Magna Carta is great, but again, you know, understand that it really wasn't, you know, a blow for the common man. Okay, it's not until much later that you get, you know, declarations of, you know, like the Bill of Rights. Okay, so that's progress, I think. But at the same time, and all of us have been, probably that have worked, have been in jobs where, you know, at least our job depended upon the whim of somebody above us that, you know, we thought was crazy. Okay, so you know kind of the terror that induces is this guy's going to, you know, have a bad day and I'm out, right? And what am I going to do for my family? So I do think that, you know, we get that idea of, in certain aspects of our lives, of being dependent upon the goodwill of somebody immediately above us. But owing them a debt of gratitude, Wiley footstomps that, and I think that's a good point to remember. Oops. All right. So, you take that structure that people basically understand. And what Christianity is going to do is, you know, so this is why Augustus needs to go up the ladder to be a deity, right? Okay, it puts him further up the ladder. Okay, well, Jesus isn't just sort of proclaiming himself God, and he's not, right? Jesus is having the witness of God the Father and the Holy Spirit, that he is God. Okay, so what happens in Christianity is that Jesus is the top of the ladder. And that passages like this, he's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things that were created through him and for him. And he's before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. So Jesus is the top of the chain of being. Okay? And everything in that chain of being is now subject to him and exists for his purposes, his glory, and at the will of his pleasure. So, Jesus and Augustus are going to clash. Augustus says, well, I know, I'll be proclaimed a god in the Roman pantheon. Okay, that, you know, maybe Jupiter is the first among equals, but they don't really have a top of their chain, right? And Jesus just trumps that and says, okay, I'm everything. Okay, all of your demigods, all these principalities and powers and authorities and everything, I'm in charge of them. I made them. Okay, so it's a grand sort of tour de force, end of argument, mic drop kind of moment culturally to the Roman Empire. In contrast, you know, here's Augustus being, there he is. I don't know, he's an emperor. Why can't he afford a shirt? I don't know. Got to wear a bathrobe or a towel, whatever that is. Okay, he's getting a little crown put on him. He's up there in this pantheon of other gods. Underneath him, okay, are his enemies. Underneath his footstool are his enemies. Okay, that should sound familiar. Okay, and the goddess that's crowning him there is Oikoumene. Okay, so that word, if you were here when Jim Jordan was in our church and occasionally teaching, should be familiar to you. Okay, so Jim used that word a lot to refer to sort of the structure of all the ancient kings and empires, sort of, you know, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Daniel 7, or the Daniel statue empires. Okay, and so this claim to be God, a false claim, obviously, because Augustus does what? Nice. At the end of his life?
Nice.
Not hard, not a trick question. He dies. Okay, and does he stay dead? He stays dead. What does Jesus do? He dies, and he doesn't stay dead. Okay, so how do you know a real God? If you kill him, he doesn't stay dead. Okay, and Augustus stays dead. So, this is for actually Pastor Ben on your Just War Sunday School, next time that resumes. Okay, if you want peace, I know the rest of the phrase?
Prepare for war.
Prepare for war. Okay, so we want peace, right? Okay, but we have to be armed and somewhat dangerous. So Jesus is making a claim counter to Augustus's claim. And when Jesus is going about building his household. So now the argument's going to shift to us, to the church. When Jesus is going to make his change in the nature of reality, what he's going to do is he's going to put two different people together. So the Word of God had resided with the Jews, okay, a distinct minority of people. And what Jesus is now doing is he's taking the Gentiles, which is not another distinct minority, it's everybody else, okay? And he's going to put them together and make one people. So, you know, the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament is not localized in the sense that God, Jehovah God, was a local deity, and you know, the nations were supposed to come to him in the Old Testament, but, you know, in reality, you know, this is knocking down the barriers to everybody that was not ethnically a Jew. Yes, Andrew?
It sounds like the ending to the scattering of people is our
Yeah. And that's really what Pentecost is a sign of that, is what happened at Babel is now being reversed in the people of God. And that's why such a point is made, I think, in early Acts about these people being from all over. You know, they're from everywhere. And all the languages. I think that's the point of that. That's good. So now, when you read Ephesians 2:19, this word oikomene is being used for the household of faith. Okay, so again, this is something that is just going to go, I mean, even if you study Greek, it's going to go right over your head. So Wiley's making the point that, oh, don't miss that word. That word really, really, really matters. Okay? We're someplace and part of something that's going on that's not just, you know, a church in Valpy. It's much, 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 much bigger than that. Okay, so I think we're mindful of that to many degrees. You know, I will just tell you, if you've never been on a mission trip like the stuff that we do in Peru now every summer, you should do that, because, you know, you step foot in a worship service in the mountains of Peru and you go, oh, the Holy Spirit's really real, because these people are worshiping the same God I am, and there is no way culturally that should happen. Okay, we're as far apart as we can get. Okay, so it's a great testimony that God is doing something in all places and all times. And you stay in one place, you kind of get in a rut. I apologize, this next slide is Walker Percy, so I don't want to not talk about it, but it's misplaced. So I'm just going to jump. All right, so let's talk about households. So I wanted to make a joke that this is a picture on Gary and Lynn's living room wall, okay, which it's close. In their old house, they had pictures like this. My family's got pictures like this. Your family's got pictures like this, unless you came from the old country in the last 50 years. And then you've got pictures in the old country like this, okay? This is typical, 1900, 1920, whatever it is, picture of a family when they decided to get together. Notice how many adults are in that picture? Okay, that's not just a mom and a dad and their 10 kids. Okay, that's aunts, uncles, grandma, grandpa. Okay, that's normal. That's what normalcy looks like in all of human history until the last 15 minutes. Okay, is you've got this big extended crowd of people because you don't live 500 miles from where you were born. Unless you all got in a wagon and rode there. Okay, you don't. You know, I was in D.C. last week, right? Okay. In theory, I made the trip in 3.5 hours with Southwest, more like 5 days. Okay. But the point is that you really, we are not used to, being born within the same 10-mile circle that our great-grandparents were born in. Okay. Now, you live in one place long enough, which, Niceville, let's say, and you realize, wow, you got five families, and they're all intermarried, and there's one, it's a bunch of different last names now, but they're all related, okay? Same thing for Crestview, a little bit less for Fort Walton. Defuniac? Oh, yeah. Okay? So, the point is that a household was something that we were all used to until the last 15 minutes of Western culture. And essentially, those were economic units, right? People made what they ate, made what they wore, collected what heated their homes, and then worked for money to exchange for the stuff they couldn't make. Okay? And 90% of your day was consumed by having your next meal and having something to wear and having something to stay warm with, right? Okay. So how long do I have to work to feed myself in a day? You know, an hour? Well, I eat a lot, maybe more. Okay. You know, we don't think like this anymore. My grandparents, who were Depression, adults in the Depression, who were millionaires, by the way, bought Julie and me, when we were in our late 20s or early 30s, a washing machine. And my grandfather stared me in the eyes and said, "Now, Michael, if I buy you this washing machine, am I going to spoil you?" I'm going, "Granddad, it's a washing machine. Hopefully, if things are going right, ask Julie the question, not me." I didn't say that out loud. I thought it. No. A washing machine, that's like an expectation, right? Okay. I'm not going to the laundromat ever again. I'm not going down to Mullet Creek and wash my clothes. So this was the group of people that kept each other alive. Yes. Sure. There's an extension of that to elderly family members, for sure. You know, there's more of the brothers and sisters towards cousins, and, you know, moms and dads towards nephews and nieces. Yes, sir?
So the Industrial Revolution changed this agronomous society, right?
Yeah.
So that happened in...
But even first Industrial Revolution, you know, the workshops are in people's houses. You know, you've got a knitting, you know, spinning mill in your shed. Okay, it wasn't. You know, factories were a later development.
So Henry Ford's problem. He's
well, I mean, I've owned a couple Fords. You sold me. No, you sold me a Chevy. There's dimensions of society that are different now because of industrialization and factories and cities. There were cities before, but most people didn't live in them. All right, so now this is his last, and I'm almost out of time, this is his last sort of excursion into the classical world. He goes to a Greek writer named Xenophon, who I had to read in college, but it was his war journey book called The Anabasis. So they've gone and fought the Persians in Persia, I might add, and now they're returning back to Greece, and it's 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,000 miles. It's a long way, and it's sort of the story of that journey back. So I didn't know he had written this book. This is very close to Oikomene. It's Oikonomikos, and that is translated the estate manager or the faithful steward. So think of that word steward for a second. That should give you an idea. And so it's a Socratic dialogue in which there's a bad estate manager named Critobulus and a good one named Ischomachus. And basically they go through, this is the typical Socratic dialogue, they go through good management, good stewardship versus bad stewardship. So I read it after he referenced it, and, you know, it's an interesting little book. And it's interesting because of the role of the wife. So remember, in Greek society, women are essentially property. So the idea that the woman is essentially going to eventually be the smartest person in the family because she's got to manage the most is in this book. And I always, you know, point out to the kids when we read the Odyssey that, you know, you have these women who are not property at all, and how countercultural that is. And it's really not until the gospel that women cease to be things. They become people. Well, they're recognized as people. He goes into that book a little bit to explain what ancient people would have normally thought about household management, stewardship, households. So he's kind of extending it a little bit. So that's the only really Greek argument or classical argument in this book. And so what I want to end on is you've got this scale of being, and in our little households, the Father is the top of that household. Okay? Like God is the top of the cosmos. And so these heavenly laws that are the basis of sort of the oikoumene, or the economy of the universe, these heavenly laws are mirrored in homes and households. Okay? And home being mom, dad, and kids is way too small of an idea. Okay? It's a much bigger idea than that. And so Julie and I used to watch Downton Abbey. So here's the patriarch of the family, right? In all English drama, class drama, who actually runs those households? That guy. And the lady that's his counterpart, that they end up falling in love, I think, in Downton Abbey. It's that guy. He's the steward of the household. He's the guy that's making everything happen. He's the guy that's kind of running things on the ground. So, the argument that we see in Ephesians, Galatians, and the pastoral epistles is that this household of faith that God is building, okay, is going to have stewards. Okay, so our pastor is one of the stewards in that household of faith. Okay, as an officer, I'm a steward. As an officer, you know, Nate's a steward in the household of faith. Okay, are there rules for stewards? You betcha. Okay, can a steward just arbitrarily decide, you know, off with your head because you said something I don't like? No way. Right? Stewards are under an authority structure and a rule and have very strict orders. Okay, so that idea is really, really key in Wiley's argument to all of these descriptions of what God is doing and putting together sort of a new oikoumene. Okay? He's building something that is going to sort of win the game. Okay? And that's the exact same verse as the last one. So we're going to start with this next week. We're going to just read the household codes. Okay, so these are the oikoumene codes. Okay? These are passages that, frankly, you know, we can read these in a lectionary reading in front of church and not have people stomp out mad. Okay, but most churches in America, you read Ephesians 21:6-9, and people are stomping out mad, right? Because that was then, this is now. Okay, we live in a different age. So Wiley's argument is going to be, he's going to put these household codes in this larger context and argue how important they are in sort of this winning the ultimate war. Okay? So, I didn't do a very good job with that last part. But, you know, it's a, you know, bottom line is that God is doing something in us in the very daily rituals, routines, and habits of our homes that are actually going to win the war. And these things are of cosmic importance. The way we live our daily lives with the people that, I guess you choose your spouse, right? Most of us did. You know, you choose your spouse, you don't choose your kids, you didn't choose your parents, you don't choose your brothers and sisters or aunts or uncles, okay? God throws us in with these people. And the way we live with them is actually winning the war. Okay? So, that's pretty encouraging to me because, you know, the tendency is to think you're not that important, that, you know, God's doing stuff with, you know, the Charlie Kirks and Bodie Bachmans of the world, but he's not going to do anything to me. Well, no. You go live faithfully, and God's actually winning in that as much as he's winning with a Vody or a Charlie or people like that. So let's pray. Dear God, have faith for today. Thank you for this time. Think about your word, and thank you for making the universe in such a way that we can play a role that matters, that allows us to really, really see who you are and experience the triumph of your word and your kingdom in our own lives. So thank you for that. Please bless our worship now. Help us to win the war in there too. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.